Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold. Welcome back, everyone, to Your Cases on Hold, episode 65. Can you believe they've been letting us do this for 65 episodes? We're just going to keep going to infinity and beyond with this work that we're doing here. For those tens of listeners that follow us regularly, if you're listening on the day we drop, it's September 3rd for the September 4th issue of JBJS. As always, the takes here are hot. They're creative, they're insightful, and sometimes intentionally controversial. That's our own takes here, not the journal editor-in-chief or the deputy editors or the board of trustees, board of directors, other editors from the other journals of JBJS. And who are we giving you these hot takes? I'm Andrew Schoenfeld, deputy editor for Methods at the Journal. And I have with me, as always,
deputy editor Antonia Chen of Adult Reconstruction.
There you go. If you've been following along, you know what we do here. If you're new, welcome. We're going to be covering the best that JBJS has to offer. In addition, this episode is brought to you by JBJS CME. You can not only get the best in each issue here, but you can get the best CME. You don't need to spend 3 days traveling somewhere for 15 CME credits, spending thousands of dollars. You don't have to leave your office. You don't have to leave your home. From the comfort of your own office chair, you can get all the CME that you need. Get credit for listening to us. Get credit for JBJS that you're reading. It's all good at JBJS CME. So definitely check that out, jbjs.org. You can look at everything that they have to offer. Let's get into the top of the pile. We have Periprosthetic Joint Infection and Mortality, a call to action by our editor-in-chief, Dr. Bhandari. That is permanently free. That's his take on an article that we're actually going to cover, spoiler, in the Your Cases on Hold featurette. So stay tuned for that. And we'll see what we think about a call to action in that context. Then we have What's New in Osteoporosis, Emphasis on the Aging Athlete by Kong and colleagues, also permanently free. Pediatric Device Innovation and Analysis of Food and Drug Administration Authorizations Over Time by Dubin. The Role of Journals in Reporting Sex and Gender-Based Outcomes. Should we adopt guidelines and what else can we do to improve reporting? By yours truly. And I know everybody is going to be reading that one. This is part of the Sex and Gender Symposium, NIH-funded symposium that was run by JBJS in November of 2023. Various articles have been populating throughout the issues kind of over the summer. This is the only one that happens to be in this issue, but definitely give that a look. Slope Osteotomies in the Setting of Anterior Cruciate Ligament Deficiency by Kayal and colleagues. What's Important, Building the Practice Your Community Needs by Porta Layton, also permanently free. An in-depth analysis of public and private research funding in orthopedic surgery from 2015 to 2021 by Shaw. AOA Critical Issue Symposium, Advancing Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion in Orthopedic Surgery by Tabai and colleagues. And then we have 10-year follow-up of posterior decompression and fusion surgery for thoracic ossification of the posterior longitudinal ligament by Ito and colleagues. Let's see what's new in the headlines this week. I am presenting low-intensity pulsed ultrasound versus sham in the treatment of operatively managed scaphoid non-unions, the SNAP-U randomized controlled trial. This is by White and colleagues and does come with a commentary and an infographic. So for our visual learners, you have something. And then for others who don't like what I have to say about it, see what someone else thought about it in this context. So definitely listen to what I have to say and then see what others thought. Read it in the journal. So this is a randomized controlled trial, well done from as a primer, essentially. We've had a lot of these recently, but really, if you want to write a randomized controlled trial, you could just sort of follow the ultrastructure of what these authors did, and I think you'd be well situated for that. This is a very interesting study using low-intensity pulsed ultrasound. The background being is that this has been used in animal models to help with fracture union in high-risk or frank non-union situations. but the clinical translation in human subjects is somewhat limited. So these authors sought to assess whether active low-intensity pulsed ultrasound accelerated time to union following surgery for scaphoid non-union, assessing this using CT scans as a gold standard. And then they had an adjudication committee that actually made the determinations, but not in real time. And we'll get back to that later. Essentially, after the surgery, there was a window in the cast. The patients applied either a sham or an active low-intensity pulse ultrasound unit. They had 142 subjects who completed the study. They were supposed to have a few more, about 12 more, but were unable to complete the enrollment because of issues with COVID. That's probably not that big a deal in this context, and we'll touch on that in a few. But average age group was 27 years, overwhelmingly male, and they found no difference in the time to union with a hazard ratio of 0.965 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.663 to 1.4, essentially. And then they found no difference between the active group and the sham group with respect to any of the secondary outcomes except for wrist flexion at baseline and final follow-up, which is really not that significant clinically. And at final follow-up, the p-value was also fairly marginal at 0.04, essentially. So their conclusion is treatment with the low-intensity ultrasound had no effect on reducing time to union in patients who underwent surgical fixation for an established scaphoid non-union. It is level one evidence. I think one of like the real important findings here and why I say that the issue with their sample not reaching their predetermined number is not that big a deal is the point estimate for the magnitude of effect in the hazard ratio. This is 0.97, essentially. You know, ideally, what you're looking for there is an effect size that approximates 1.0, because that's essentially the null. So an effect size of 1.0, essentially, and then a 95% confidence interval that says the lower bound 1.0 and the upper bound 1.0. That's never going to happen, of course. You'd have to have like an infinitesimally large study. But when you see that effect size that's right at about 1.0, that's really showing you that the signal is that there's no difference here. And yes, their confidence interval is wider than that because, again, they only are enrolling 142 patients. But I think that's definitely reassuring for us. And I don't think like, oh, they should have enrolled 12 more patients because I don't think that was going to change the finding. They do point out that they utilize serial CT scans and an adjudication committee, which I thought was interesting, to make time to union as objective as possible. But the problem there is it wasn't done in real time. So like the surgeon could say, yes, this is fixed, fused, healed. And then the adjudication committee would be like, no, it's not. We disagree. And then that wouldn't trigger additional clinical evaluation. They wouldn't do further CT scans or anything along those lines. So that's kind of a unique aspect and a caveat that they cover in the limitations. I think it's reasonable to like bring it up. How much it impacts this, I'm not so sure. Ultimately, the CT scan is the gold standard, and they have this adjudication committee. So the input of many is likely to be more objective than just the input of a single individual. So you probably go with the determinations of the adjudication committee, at least, you know, from the standpoint of scientific rigor. And there certainly isn't enough here to support the routine use of this, which is their main conclusion. And I'm on board with that based on the work that was done and the findings that they have. And again, just sort of the face validity and integrity of that point estimate is tough to beat.
I give a lot of credit to these types of studies because I don't think we publish a lot of negative studies, in all honesty. A lot of times there's a positive bent to it or some sort of finding with it. And you just don't need that for every single study. So I applaud them, and this is something that I think people do regularly and helped answer a good question.
All right. So let's hear about your headline, a matched comparison of implant and functional outcomes of cemented and cementless unicompartmental knee replacements, a study from the National Joint Registry for England, Wales, Northern Ireland, and the Isle of Man, and the Hospital Episode Statistics Patient-Reported Outcome Measured Database by Muhammad and colleagues, also with a commentary.
It's a long title, I will say for sure. One of the concerns of cemented total partial knee arthroplasty, or UKA, is extrusion of cement in the posterior part of the prosthesis.
And the idea is cementless UKEs were introduced to hopefully reduce this this complication, provide better fixation, et cetera. One of the cementless UK implants have been on the market for multiple years in the UK. It has not been brought to the US yet. There was one introduced in the US, but it's been since taken off the market. This study compares cemented and cementless Oxford UKE, which is one specific brand. The study utilized the National Joint Registry for England, Wales, Northern Ireland, and the Isle of Man to compare cementless and cementless Oxford UKE, specifically at PROMS, has been collected in this database since 2009. This study included 50,926 medial Oxford unis recorded in the NJR database, but only 14,764 were successfully linked to the HES PROMS data set. Again, it started in 2009. So the study population was even whittled down further to 6,906 UKEs, of which 3,453 were cemented and 3,053 were cementless because they were propensity score match based on patient, surgical, and implant factors. They excluded BMI, which I thought would have been a really nice factor to add. They had too much missing data for it, but BMI would have been a nice addition because I think it would be really good to see how BMI bore on this, because BMI in cementless total knee arthroplasties have been shown to be better versus cemented. Evaluation was based on surgeon caseload. They defined a low caseload surgeon as having less than 10 UKs per year, a medium caseload surgeon have 10 to less than 30 UKs per year, and a high caseload surgeon of having 30 or more UKs per year. For patient-reported outcomes, it only included preoperative and six-month postoperative scores, the Oxford Knee Score and the EQ-5D, looking at quality of life. It did not include any other patient-reported outcomes, and it didn't go past 6 months, which they stated wasn't necessary because outcomes after 6 months to 1 year were pretty similar and marginally different. The results showed a 10-year cumulative implant survivorship rate of 93%. And for cementless total knee replacements, for cementless partial knee replacements, and 91.3% for cemented UKAs. The revision rate, there was significantly lower for cementless UKAs with a hazard ratio of 0.74. And subgroup analysis showed a stronger effect size among partial knee replacements performed by high caseload surgeons. Looking specifically at the Oxford Knee Score, it showed that those in the cementless group were significantly higher in the postoperative period compared to the cemented group. The difference was about a point, or actually a little less than a point. The cementless group gained 1.1 more points than the cemented group, according with the whole study and the whole groups taken into consideration. The differences in Oxford Knee Score points gained postoperatively was highest among partial knee replacements performed by high caseload surgeons, with the cementless group gaining 1.8 points more than the cemented group, again, specifically for these high caseload surgeons. EQ5D, it showed that the postoperative scores were not significantly different between groups, and the cementless group gained 0.334 points postoperatively, was significantly more than the 0.314 points gained by the cemented group. And the groups with the surgeon caseload were greater than 30, there were significantly higher in the post-op EQ5D versus cemented one. So the cementless UKA demonstrated better 10-year implant survivorship and postoperative functional outcomes than the cemented UKA, although I will give the caveat that the differences were very small, but the patient population was large. It would be nice to know the outcomes of patient-reported outcomes such as COOS and COOS Jr. Or JR, because those are the ones that we use typically in the United States, and payers are also looking at that as well too in terms of outcomes. I know that this is a national database study, so because of that, it's hard to see radiographic study outcomes, but I would love to see radiographic outcomes, because one of the interesting things about cementless UKA is that you don't have to chase the cement in the back of the knee. And again, the study only include medial unis. Lateral unis would be nice to evaluate as well, but you wouldn't be able to include mobile bearing implants. And it would be nice to see the study in fixed bearing implants of cemented versus cementless to see if the outcomes still bear out if in a mobile bearing, in a fixed bearing setting, because this study was only looking at mobile bearing implants. And that's my take.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting study. There's a lot of rich clinical details that are covered. I think for when looking at, you know, applying this to clinical practice, it's important for clinicians to kind of take a look at the demographic tables, the outcomes, see how it matches up or how it relates to their own practices. And then they have to decide, you know, if they're going to apply it. I mean, that's basically what it comes down to. Do you agree?
I agree. It depends on a lot of factors with that too. So, and I'm curious, this is obviously looking at just one population, right? This is the NJR data, which is good and pretty comprehensive, but I would really love to see it on a different scale, obviously, throughout. But it hasn't been approved in many other countries. So this would be one of those things where it would be beneficial to see it bore out in different areas.
Next up, we have the Your Cases on Hold featurette, association between periprosthetic joint infection and mortality following primary total hip arthroplasty. This is a study that was conducted as a population-based retrospective cohort study in Ontario, Canada. The kind of study that, like, you need these large population-based registries in order to conduct. Really interesting work. That's why it was selected by Dr. Bhandari, our editor-in-chief, for comment. And I think, heads up, this is going to be a testable item for sure. So this is involving individuals who underwent first primary elective total hip for arthritis between April of 2002 and March of 2021. And the primary outcome was death within 10 years after the index total hip arthroplasty. And the mortality was compared between propensity score matched groups, those who had TJI within 1 year, and those who did not have an infection within 1 year. So they had a total of 175,432 patients. 868 patients, or about 0.5%, underwent surgery for an infection of a replaced joint within 1 year after the index procedure. So they're doing propensity score matching as a way to kind of control for the confounding there. And what they did was they matched to those who did not have a PJI within 1 year in a one-to-one ratio on the basis of age, plus or minus 1 year, biologic sex, class 3 obesity, the year of the index for surgery, and then the propensity score for the occurrence of PJI. So it's not a pure propensity score match, it seems. And their PJI propensity score was based on age, sex, and income quintile, as well as comorbidities, Charlson score, frailty, and class 3 obesity. The one issue that I guess could have been characterized better, this is not something that I handled as a methods editor, but it seems to me that, like, in the propensity score, they have age, sex, income quintile, comorbidities, and the Charlson score, which is also comorbidities. So how that was parsed out, I'd like to know better. And then they took that and then adjusted again on they matched on age, biologic sex, the propensity score, and class 3 obesity. So it's like you have the propensity score and then you're matching on stuff in the propensity score, but then the same things again. That doesn't exactly seem like the best process to me. It's like, if you're using the propensity score, just match on the propensity score. If there was a problem with that, I think that needed to be a little bit more transparent. But they do a couple of sensitivity tests, which is interesting. Repeat the primary analysis, matching on primary surgeon, repeat the main analysis, excluding patients over 60, determine whether there was a relationship between the occurrence of infection at another site, specifically pneumonia, and mortality. That's an interesting proof of concept, although pneumonia is certainly not on the same magnitude of infection as an infected total joint. But after matching, they found that patients in the infection group had about, a significantly higher mortality rate that amounted to over fivefold increase in the risk of mortality, 5.49. That kind of makes sense. One of my mentors in my health services research program was very interested in sort of the arc of patients' lives following recovery from sepsis. Patients who recover from sepsis, their kind of clinical trajectory, the arc of their lives is, you know, there's a total frame shift. And I think there's a lot of correlations between that and what you see with patients with joint infections, particularly something where it's in the hip and very close to the spine. And you're not just talking about systemic effects, but also effects that it has on secondary mobility and physical function, such that that can also lead to downstream effects on cardiovascular and fitness, increasing frailty, and all these can accumulate into a greater risk of mortality in the near term. And I think that that's what we're seeing. But a few things that I thought were really interesting and maybe make it a little bit less clean cut as far as I'm concerned. So after they matched for surgeon, right? After they matched on the surgeon who did the intervention, the risk of mortality was lower, went from 5.49 to 3.28, which I don't know how I think about that exactly. That would seem to indicate that a fair amount of the risk of mortality is based on the surgeon who's doing the procedure.
Yeah, that's what it seems like it is, which is interesting. And I don't know if that matters because people bias towards maybe more invasive procedures, less invasive procedures. I can see that burning out with like two stage and one stage versus like a DARE procedure, I guess.
That's a big, you went from
a huge jump in mortality. Yeah,
5.49 to 3.28.
Yeah. It's a big deal.
Yeah, pretty remarkable. It makes the effect size, the point estimate for the effect size, lower than the lower bound of the 95% confidence interval on their primary measurement. That's kind of remarkable.
That is very remarkable.
Yeah. Then they have the sensitivity analysis for patients under 60 years old. They only had 215 patients in this group. It's a really small number comparatively. And after matching, this group had a significantly higher 10-year mortality rate. That's 10.18, meaning like if you're under 60 and you get an infection, I think that shows that there's like a whole lot of other things that are really going on. Like, you know, just the mere fact that you got the infection is a marker for a problem. But the 95% confidence interval there goes from 1.3 to 79.6. I think that's a real problem. Like, I don't think that this is useful information really that's being presented out of this sensitivity test, just because of the lack of precision and other factors that may be playing into it. Like propensity score matching and their analytic approach, it's not perfect. Like it's not giving you a clear cut, unadulterated, holistic appreciation. I think this is one that I wouldn't invest in that particular finding. I think the primary finding, absolutely, you can be confident about it, makes sense. The first sensitivity analysis around the primary surgeon, food for thought, not sure what to do with that. I think also, again, and probably not surprisingly, pneumonia didn't have an impact on 10-year mortality. I don't think that really changes anything. I would say that, you know, a hip infection is much more serious than pneumonia. Now, if you did it for like epidural abscess and hip infection, and it showed like epidural abscess has no impact, I would love to do this study in epidural abscess. I think that the folks who have access to this registry, if you're listening, look into doing this for epidural abscess. I think that would be an important study down the road to understand similar the parameters. There's a lot of corollaries or spine surgical infections. This is just a call me up, like hit me up. Let's do this together.
I'm done. I think it's a good call for collaborators, call for research people. This is it. If you do it, there's a way to get in touch with Dr. Schoenfeld.
All right. Anything else that you have on that front?
No, I second that. I think it's an interesting topic. I don't think it's controversial in terms of the findings behind it, but be careful what you do when it comes to infection.
So just in case you didn't get it, this is the article by Mundy and colleagues. There is a visual summary. It is 30 days free. So do definitely check it out for yourself. And Dr. Mundy and colleagues, get a hold of me. Let's do some more studies together. All right. Honorable mentions, the predictors of surgery for symptomatic, atraumatic, full-thickness rotator cuff tears change over time. 10-year outcomes of the Moon Shoulder Prospective Cohort by Kuhn and colleagues. This is with an infographic permanently free. They have 452 patients in the original cohort with a number that withdrew, leaving a total of 115 who underwent surgical procedure at some point during the 10-year follow-up. 56.5% underwent surgery within 6 months of enrollment and 43.5% between 6 months and 10 years. They found low patient expectations regarding the efficacy of physical therapy were a predictor of early surgery. Workers' compensation status and activity level were more important predictors of later surgery. Patient-reported outcome measures all improved following physical therapy. For patients who did not undergo a surgical procedure, the reported outcome measures did not decline over the 10-year follow-up period. So they conclude low patient expectations regarding the efficacy of PT were a predictor of early surgery. Workers' comp and activity level were predictors of later surgery. Interesting study from the Moon cohort. do give that a look, particularly if you're working in the shoulder space. And then we have validating orthopedic data evaluation panel ODEP ratings across 9 orthopedic registries. Total hip implants with an ODEP rating perform better than those without an ODEP rating by Hoogervorst and colleagues. This is permanently free. This study was done involving 313 total hip cups and 356 total hip stems, 218 total hip cup stem combinations, and 68 total knee implants with unique brand names reported by registries that were matched to an ODEP, that's the Orthopedic Data Evaluation Panel rating. At all follow-up time points, those matched total hip implants had lower cumulative revision risks than total hip implants without a rating. This is level 3 data, but they do feel that given that the performance of total hip implants varied across countries, registries should first validate the ODEP ratings and use country-specific revision data to better guide implant selection in their country. Data source transparency and the use of revision data for multiple registries, they feel would strengthen the ODEP benchmarks. So some recommendations that are very pertinent to quality improvement, as well as further evaluation in this setting and context. That's about all we have for this episode. We've run out of time. We'll try to do better next time. Remember to like and subscribe, hit the notification, make sure you're getting every episode, access our back issues. If you like what you heard, please come back for the next one. If you didn't, come back anyway. I'm telling you, it's going to be great discussion in the next episode. A lot of rich articles. Give it another try. Let's keep this going. Your case is hopefully ready to go wherever you are. All the cases here still on hold.